Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her first book in over 20 years, Gloria Steinem, writer, activist, and organizer, offers a candid account of how her early years led her to an on-the-road kind of life, traveling, listening to people, learning, and creating change. In My Life on the Road, Steinem writes about some of the extraordinary people, famous and not, from whom she has learned along the way. She also reflects on how the most transformative ideas sometimes come from unexpected people and encounters. Gloria Steinem co-founded Ms. Magazine and helped found New York Magazine. In 2013, she received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama. Again, the new book is My Life on the Road, and it is a great pleasure and an honor to welcome Gloria Steinem to the Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
It's a pleasure for me. Thank you.
At what point, especially since it's been a while since the last book, and I know you insist that this is not a memoir, so where did you get the idea to write about life on the road?
I suddenly realized that though I had been writing about some things I saw on the road, people, issues, elections, I was writing the very least about what I was doing the very most, and that being on the road, especially as an organizer, was a state of mind in itself. So I wanted to record what I see because I think it's what keeps me optimistic, or at least not in total despair. And I also wanted to open up the road a bit for female travelers because I think the road has been wrongly regarded as a male province because it's regarded as dangerous. And I was kind of hoping that maybe a small percentage of people might consider being traveling organizers themselves.
The one thing that you get from this book that you make extremely clear is that that road can be anything but dangerous. You find it to be very loving, very embracing, very informative.
That's true. I mean, I don't mean to downplay the danger. I am not foolhardy. I'm cautious about some kinds of places. But I do think that, especially for women, it's perceived as being more dangerous than it is. And while I was writing this, I realized that actually, statistically speaking, the home is more dangerous for women. In this country, at least, and I'm sure in others too, you're more likely, statistically, you're more likely to be hurt or even murdered in your own home by someone you know, if you're a female.
You write in the book that the road is messy in the way that real life is messy. It leads us out of denial and into reality, out of theory and into practice, out of caution and into action, out of statistics and into stories. In short, out of our heads and into our hearts.
That's true. That's definitely true. Of course, I will add the proviso that I am suggesting an on-the-road state of mind. I mean, I think it's probably possible to go to the same chains everywhere, to, you know, listen to your iPod everywhere, I mean, you know, just not to be open to what it is you're seeing. But I think for me, the road is, you know, I live in the future. I think maybe we acquire our habits of mind when we're children. And because I was always, as a child, hoping to get out of Toledo or wherever I was, I got the habit of living in the future. The road forces me to live in the present. And though my friends have tried to get me to meditate, and something in which I totally believe, mindfulness, meditation, I've taken courses, I still have never really practiced it in my life. And I think that's because the road is my form of meditation.
It seems in the writing of the book that the one trip that truly changed you was India.
That's true. It took me a while to realize it because I was in India as a 22 to 24-year-old. I was kind of escaping there because I didn't know what to do with my life. It was only a decade or so after independence, so it was full of the kind of interest that later South Africa would have. Mm-hmm. It seemed so intense and so different that it took me quite a while after I came home to realize I'd learned something that applied everywhere, not just in India. And that was really, to say it most simply, that change starts from the bottom up, not from the top down. That how we live, we do what we see more than what we're told. That we need to sit in circles and say what happened to us or tell our stories and be listened to. You know, I think that we've been doing this, you know, for thousands of years, probably. You know, we've been following the animals, the seasons. We've been migratory, sitting around campfires. It's probably in our cells by now. But still, for a long time, I thought that the experience I had in India was not applicable here. And it was really only seeing what happened in social justice movements and especially experiencing it in the women's movement and to some extent the anti-war movement and others that made me realize, wait a minute, what I learned in India is important here.
And it was in those circles and the act of listening. And that translated. You realize
yes, it does.
That has translated.
It does. It's a human event. We want to be heard. We need to be heard. You know, I think some pretty simple guidelines, there are no strict rules, but I think some guidelines can help us to make change from the bottom up and experience it in our daily lives. And one of them, as you say, is listening. I mean, if we're in a situation where we have had or still have maybe more power than the people around us, we need to listen as much as we talk. And if we have had less power, we need to talk as much as we listen, which is sometimes just as difficult because we've become accustomed to hiding. And just that balance makes a kind of instant equality or mutual respect from which you can build.
Do you think that just in your lifetime and the time that you have been on the road, that we have gotten away from listening? We have gotten worse at it.
You know, I'm not sure. That's a good question. You know, I did once write a long essay about the politics of talking, and I did discover while researching that people are very fond of making studies of talking, but almost nobody makes studies of listening. We perceive the active as the more preferable, and I think you're right that we need to develop much more the art of actually listening. But there is some more emphasis on it, I think, because there has come to be, out of the social justice movements and out of the awareness movements in general, more of an emphasis on our immediate, personal, visceral relationships.
As part of a movement, was there a specific point or a time where you realized that you were being listened to?
Yes, I think so. In the beginning, I thought I had to write to be listened to because I somehow thought writing was way more serious than talking. As I had a kind of hierarchy of human communication in my brain. Poems were more serious than novels. Novels were more serious than journalism.
Sure.
Writing was more serious than talking. Whereas, you know, the art form is just to pick the right mode for what it is you're trying to communicate, not to make a hierarchy out of it. The sense of being heard came from, in my experience of organizing, which means, well, first of all, I was terrified of public speaking. So this, you know, I mean, I'm big time terrified. And I put a lot of effort into not doing it until I was in my late 30s. Discovering I didn't die, which was a big discovery, came about the same time as discovering that I was listened to. And fortunately, because I was scared to speak, I always left at least as much time for discussion afterwards. So I was lucky that it came to me accidentally in a balanced situation That is, I discovered that I was listened to and discovered I could listen at about the same time.
I also found it fascinating in the book that in that period when you were going out to speak and because you were terrified, you would go out with other women.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't have gone otherwise. I think that public speaking is right up there with death in the opinion polls of what people are afraid of, so I'm not alone. But because I couldn't publish what I wanted to publish about the burgeoning excitement and, you know, electricity of the women's movement, and the editors I'd been working for were spectacularly not interested. And because I had published a couple of pieces in New York Magazine where I was, you know, one of the little founding group of writers, I was getting invitations to speak. So I realized that that was the only way I was going to be able to communicate this, but I really couldn't do it by myself. So I asked a friend of mine who I thought, you know, because people were saying to me, well, you're not married, you don't have children, you know, they'll kill you in Dubuque or so, you know, that I should speak with somebody who had different experience from mine. So Dorothy Pittman Hughes, who was not only married with children, but also an expert in child rearing and started a child care center, you know, I asked her because I knew she was fearless. And also, though this was not the first reason, because she's African-American, I'm European-American or white or whatever you want to call it. And it was a little bit accidental that we did it together because we were friends, but it turned out that we were able to speak to audiences that neither one of us ever, ever would have got on our own. So after Dorothy had a baby and wanted to stay home, then I continued to do it with Florence Kennedy, with Margaret Sloan, with Jane Galvin Lewis, with African-American friends, and we became what Flo Kennedy referred to as Little Eva Pears, something for everyone. You have to know how outrageous Flo was to understand that comment.
Gloria Steinem is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is My Life on the Road. You write in the book that it was important for you also, and you learned this in India, that by going with women, African-American women, as well as women from First Nations, that was important to you because they were there first.
Yes, absolutely. I hope someday the history of the movement is more accurate than it is right now, and more accurate about the suffragist era, too, because we still have not really recorded the fact that the early suffragists were really inspired by the women of the Iroquois Confederacy, especially in upstate New York, where the Seneca women and the women who would become the early suffragists were in the same area and having Sunday dinner together. And the Native American women were just appalled by the fate of the European American women. They called them those who die in childbirth. They couldn't believe it. Because after all, they had come from Europe at the absolute pit of European experience and a profound patriarchy in which women were absolutely controlled. And then, but they, the European American women, could see here sitting next to them were these women in chamois trousers and beaded tunics, comfortable, while they were in corsets and, you know, 120 pounds of skirts and so on. And they could see that in their nearby cultures, they were equal. They controlled, the women controlled their own fertility and decided when and whether to have children. They controlled agriculture by and large. The men hunted, but those activities were considered equal and balanced. The paradigm of the culture was the circle, not the pyramid. So, you know, in large part, the suffrage movement was inspired by the cultures that were already here in Indian country, and we don't credit that either. We've only just begun to credit that our Constitution came from the Iroquois Confederacy. Not enough of it, because it retained slavery and excluded women, but the layered notion of it and the actual physical structure that Benjamin Franklin understood was what the 13 colonies needed came from them.
Have you been able to figure out what it is about the stages of a movement, and for want of a better term, a fight, in the sense of that women have to fight, African Americans have to fight, homosexuals have to fight, mm-hmm. that we don't learn in one point that there is such a thing as human rights.
Mm-hmm. It's true what you say, that each group comes forward and struggles to become visible, to name itself, to name its own experience, and to become independent. But I do think that the natural next stage is interdependence. Then we figure out, you know, that the movements are all connected. But in their origin, probably there's more emphasis on just becoming visible, you know, just mm-hmm. naming yourself and saying, wait a minute, here I am, and I'm human and okay too.
And is it necessary to have that fight, meaning you can't reach that sense of equality that the other group has reached until you have waged that war yourself?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think it probably is, not in an unpleasant sense, but in a discovery of your own strength mm. sense. If someone gives you power, you're too weak to use it. You gain your strength in the process of understanding your situation, of all the great ahas of, oh, it doesn't have to be like this. I'm not crazy. The system is crazy. And you become strong enough to take your power. There are all kinds of cases around the world in which constitutions have given people power they haven't used, haven't been able to use, because they didn't have a role in writing the constitutions or in taking that power.
So at what point can we take that power? How long do we have to wait?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we have to wait at all. It depends on the size of the group we're talking about. We're communal creatures. We need each other. We need to tell our stories and listen to other people's stories to know that our experience is shared. But we probably do this in ever-expanding concentric circles. And I do have faith that we are getting back to, and can get back to, in a new way, because we're not, you know, you can't go to the past. But the societies of the original cultures where the paradigm was a circle, where we understood that people were linked, we were not ranked. And the ancient cultures, which, because they were not patriarchies, which is how hierarchy starts, with controlling reproduction and therefore controlling women's bodies and therefore saying only sex that can end in reproduction is okay. You know, sex between two women or between two men is not okay because it doesn't end in reproduction, which is wrong. I mean, you know, sexuality has always been a way that we reach out to each other and express caring and bonding and so on. But we've been told that lie for a long time. So it's going to take us a while to untell it, but we do it in concentric circles and through truth-telling, because even people who are very biased, once they discover they love and care about somebody who is the supposedly unacceptable person, even they, you know, that I think, obviously we've seen that in this country, can begin to change.
Gloria Steinem is our guest. The name of the new book is My Life on the Road. You write about your parents in this book and learned a lot about the relationship that you had with your father. He was a large man, larger than life,
mm-hmm.
and large, and also always on the road.
Yes, he had two big points of pride. He never wore a hat, which in his generation one was supposed to do, and he never had a job, by which he meant he always worked for himself.
Mm.
He was a dreamer. You know, he always had an idea of, you know, when I say dreamer, I mean he would invent an orange drink or a new kind of motel or a kind of slogan. I mean, it wasn't what you might consider high art, It didn't matter. I mean, it was a dream.
A motel that you could open up the roof and get a tan.
Oh, you remember that. That's amazing.
Yes.
Yes.
That's cool.
Santana motels, he was going to call them. You could crank back the roof and get a suntan.
How did you react to that at the time, that dreaming aspect?
I don't know. It was fun. It was exciting. It took me a while into my adulthood to realize that the dreams kind of never worked out, and then even longer to realize that it didn't matter because the dream was what was important.
You also write that because you were on the road, and once you went to school and started that path, you weren't there when he passed away. How hard was that for you, especially when the relationship with your mother was difficult because she had what they called then, I assume, a nervous breakdown?
Yes. I mean, my mother was somebody frequently who needed to be taken care of. I mean, she was a loving, smart, wonderful woman, but she couldn't always take care of herself. And so our roles got kind of reversed when I was young, and I was often looking after her. But my father definitely could look after himself, so I worried about him less. And I think I didn't realize nearly as soon how important he was, therefore, in my life. You know, I think children are drawn to the more vulnerable parent sometimes for all those reasons. So it took me a while to realize how alike my father and I were in many ways, and how grateful I am to him. I mean, that I've had kind and funny and good men in my life is totally due to my father, who told me by his very being that kind and funny and wonderful men existed. He never had a home in his life, and I did rebel against that because we were living in a house trailer when I was young and I wanted to go to school like the other kids. So it took me a while to realize that I had inherited, or not inherited, but absorbed from him some really important things, like the ability to live with insecurity, which freelance writers definitely need, and the joy of spontaneity in the road.
You have made it very clear that men have a role in feminism. Do you think he helped you in that principle and understanding?
Probably, because, you know, I think that women who have had cruel and even abusive fathers, it's harder for them, because they've grown up that way, to know that doesn't have to be true. Mm. So I didn't have to spend time. I mean, I knew that there were cruel and abusive men, but I knew that there were men like my father too. So it probably saved a great deal of time. But I think we can all come out in the same place, because it's clear that the gender roles are a prison for everybody, and the masculine gender role may be, you know, have wall-to-wall carpeting and people to serve you coffee and so on, but it's still a prison. And men become whole people by being either raising children or being raised to raise children, because the qualities that are wrongly called feminine are just those qualities you need to raise children, the patience, empathy, attention to detail, and so on. Just as women become whole people by adventuring outside the house and discovering the ability to be daring or to follow your dreams or your talents or what. But the goal for both of us, for both women and men, is to understand that we have all human qualities. The whole circle of human qualities is in each of us.
Your mother shared a lot. There are many similarities in your mother's early life of what her ambition was and what you ultimately have done.
Mm-hmm. I know I ask myself that question, would I have become a writer if it hadn't been for my mother? I think so, because I love it so much. It's the only thing that I, when I'm doing it, I don't think I should be doing something else. Mm. And I totally grew up on Louisa May Alcott, who was a writer. But it is true that I am also living out the unlived life of my mother. I think there are a lot of daughters and sons, too, who are living out the unlived lives of their parents.
Gloria Steinem's new book is My Life on the Road, published by Random House. Gloria Steinem, thanks so much for being with us and sharing with us.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Special thanks to Paula Ruest and Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.